The scripture lesson from Joshua is found on page 215 and 216 in your pew Bibles. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and summoned the elders, the heads, the judges, and the officers of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all these people,
"Now therefore revere the Lord and serve God in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods that your ancestors served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. Now, if you are unwilling to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord."
Then the people answered,
"Far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For it is the Lord our God who brought us and our ancestors up from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who did those great signs in our sight. God protected us along all the way that we went, and among all the peoples through whom we passed. And the Lord drove out before us all the peoples, the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore, we also will serve the Lord."
May God bless this reading to our understanding.
Let's pause for just a word of prayer, please. Gracious God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, for you are indeed our rock and our redeemer, our salvation. You are the one to whom we turn in all things. Amen. Back in my early youth ministry days, my father and I were invited to serve together at a high school campus, a high school summer church camp up in the mountains of Southern California. My dad was invited to be the keynote speaker. I was there to coordinate all the recreation activities for the high schoolers who would be there for 7 days of good times in the mountains. And my dad was an interesting choice. Folks who were organizing this camp kind of had more of a fundamentalist background, and they thought it would be kind of fun to have my dad, who had this reputation for being this sort of crazy radical preacher from the inner city of San Francisco, to come down to Southern California and preach to these kids. And he was a great preacher, and trust me, he did a great job that week at camp. He really did. He spent 45 minutes every night at campfire. Not a kid got bored. Not a kid scuffled the dirt or anything. They stayed right with him. There were about 150 young people up there in the mountains for that week of camp. And my dad just was terrific. He was challenging. He was funny. He was inspiring. He was all the things you'd hope that a youth speaker would be. Until the last night of camp. You see, like I mentioned, the guys who were in charge of this camp, the two ministers who were running it, were a little more fundamentalist in their background and their belief, and they always had a Friday night commitment service. And the Friday night commitment service was the time when kids would be invited to give their hearts to Jesus, to follow Jesus, and to make a decision to do so. And usually, you know, half the camp would come forward and make a decision like that. In fact, I remember as a kid growing up, I went to a couple of camps like this. I remember one specifically when I was 12. I was in the 7th grade, and it came to commitment night, and there was a preacher there, not my dad, but there was a preacher there who got up and gave his sermon, his talk at the campfire, and towards the end he said, "If you don't give your heart to God, you need to be careful, because if your bus crashes on the way home and you die, you may not go to heaven." He wasn't kidding. I thought about that at 12. I was pretty careful to think about that, because it was a very winding road back down the mountain. And I was a little bit uncertain about what exactly this meant. You know, as an adult, though, I've thought about it too, and that's really kind of more of a theological terrorism, really, to use fear and guilt to frighten people into following Jesus. That's not what my dad did. They were expecting, not maybe that something that obnoxious, but they were expecting that my dad would give a call. Instead, he did something altogether different. He didn't preach for 45 minutes. He preached for 2. And his sermon was basically this: We've been preaching this week and teaching this week on the Sermon on the Mount. And in that sermon, Jesus invites you and instructs me to pray for those who persecute us, to love our enemies. We've been looking at Matthew 25, my dad said, that parable of Jesus where he invites us to understand that any time we feed the hungry, any time we give a cup of cold water to the thirsty, any time we give a blanket to someone who's cold, visit someone who's in prison, it's as though we're visiting God. Now, if you're willing to give your life to that work, then you come and stand at this campfire and you proclaim that you're going to follow Jesus. But if you're not ready to do that, then don't you come forward. And he sat down. And no one came forward. And the music played and a song was sang and no one came forward. The camp directors were not real happy. It wasn't quite what they wanted. But my dad was clear. This is a serious choice. This is a hard path to follow. And if you're going to take this one, then take it. But if not, get out of the way, because the rest of us are trying to follow in the footsteps of Jesus. I can't say for certain, but I'll bet you a dollar that Joshua would have liked that sermon. This old, grizzled Israelite warrior would have loved hearing a sermon like that. He gave one similar. You heard an excerpt from it just a moment ago with Jerry Haney in his great, wonderful voice, reading us the words of Joshua. It's a very clear sermon. Choose this day whom you will serve, the one God of all or the little gods of the lands that surround us. Joshua was a tremendous leader, an amazing preacher. He's reminding his people of what's happened before. In his sermon, he summarizes the 40 years of wandering they've done in the desert. In his sermon, he lets them know all the amazing things that God has done. We sung about one of them earlier in the worship service, in our processional hymn, the manna in the desert. You were fed miraculously. You were led through the waters of the Red Sea in an amazing way. And do you remember Moses standing before Pharaoh, the strongest political leader in the world, and proclaiming to that one, "Let my people go"? You were the oppressed. You were the slaves. You were the ones who were stepped on and pushed aside, and God heard your call. Now, Joshua proclaims, we're ready to move, to cross the river, to go into the land flowing with milk and honey, the land rich in resources, rich in abundance of fruit, life, more. Joshua calls on them to serve the Lord. Choose this day whom you will serve. The Hebrew word for serve, abad, appears in that one little portion that we read this morning 9 different times. It also can mean be a slave to. And Joshua's audience would have heard it that way. Serve the Lord. Be willing to be a slave to God. A slave to the ways of God. Give your whole self to God's work in the world. And Joshua would have been real clear. Either you're with me, or you're not. That famous line is spoken. Choose this day whom you will serve. It's a great line. It's one of the great lines of the Bible. And in my mind, if Hollywood was ever to make a movie of this scene, of this story, the character playing Joshua would have to be Sean Connery. Kind of the 50-year-old Sean Connery, you know, still kind of ruggedly handsome and tough, and maybe his hair's thinning a little bit, and he's got that full beard, and he's just up there, and he's, in my mind, he's sitting on a white stallion, and you hear that voice, that Scottish accent would be perfect. Choose this day, you know? By the way, my son told me that my Sean Connery imitation is the worst he's ever heard. You can picture it, can't you? I mean, this tough, grizzled guy up there saying, "Are you going with me or not?" It's a feel-good moment. It's an exciting day. There's no breakout sessions. There's no surveys being held. No one's asked how they feel about it. Just this commanding word. Choose this day. And the people's response. You heard their response a moment ago. Far be it from us. We'll serve God. We're with you, Joshua. Let's go. We're ready. We're excited. Let's move into this land. This promised land. We didn't read the entire story. It would take 20 or 30 minutes to read all the story of this day. But maybe you can sense what's coming next. Their reply, the one we read, is spoken in unison. That's kind of unusual. When was the last time you were in church and the whole congregation stood up together and in unison without any notes, without a bulletin to show us what to say, just responded to the sermon? I've never encountered that. It seems a little rehearsed. It seems too easy, maybe a touch insincere. In fact, later in his sermon, Joshua will respond to them and say, "I'm not sure you understand how hard this is. Are you clear that you're ready to follow?" I mean, think about that word service, that invitation to be a slave. They're to serve, to be a slave to the ways of God. And who is God? This is the God who hears the cries of the oppressed. He heard their cries when they were in slavery in Egypt. He hears the cries of the widow, of the orphan, of the immigrant, of the poorest of the poor. If you're going to follow this God, you're going to be serving that God by serving among the ones Jesus names as the least of these, and it's not going to be easy. This is a hard path. The Israelites at one time had been the oppressed. At one time they had been the poor. And now they're being expected, they're being called by Joshua to continue to work for those. Those same persons upon whom life is stepped. Walter Brueggemann is probably the best Old Testament scholar there is in the United States. He says that the decision to serve God, and this is kind of dense language, but hang with me here. The decision to serve God entails socioeconomic justice. A decision for the other gods, the lowercase g, leads inevitably to socioeconomic exploitation, the accumulation of wealth at the expense of the neighbors. If they're going to follow the one God, it will not be at the expense of their neighbors. You see, the gods and the religions that were in Palestine that surrounded the Israelites as they were preparing to move into the Promised Land were the sort of religions that said, well, if you're wealthy and healthy and everything's going well in your life, then God likes you, clearly. If you're poor and oppressed, then clearly God does not like you. And those were the sort of practices they put to work in their religion. You can find this religion, this theology, even within Christianity today. There are still those who will say, is your life blessed, everything great? Then clearly God favors you. Versus the one who may be equally as Christian in their faith and yet struck by poverty. Joshua's sermon calls them to the lowliness of service, to the lowliness of slavery, to be a slave to God and to God's ways. Now, if you've ever worked in the service industry, you know that serving is hard work, demeaning work. My sister Jerry works with foster kids out in Long Beach, California now, but she had to put her way through college. She had to pay every dime of her tuition, and she worked full-time so that she could go part-time at night and to finally earn a master's degree in social work. Jerry did this by working in a restaurant, and she worked very, very hard. I remember one time going to see her. It was the end of her shift, and she came and sat with us, and the waitress came over and brought us our food and all, and I kind of complained about the way the waitress was doing it, and boy, my little sister jumped on me and said, "You be nice. You have no idea what it's like to spend 8 hours on your feet, schlepping this food back and forth, taking care of all these people, dealing with the dishwashers and the cooks and everybody else, and you better tip her, and you better tip her at least 20%. You better, brother." It was a pretty good sermon. I tip now on. From now on, I tip 20%. If the service is good, it'll be 25%. My sister helped me see how hard it is when you are serving others, how easy it is to forget the place and where they stand. Barbara Brown Taylor makes a similar point. She's one of the greatest preachers in America. In order to earn her way through school, she served as a cocktail waitress and talks about how hard it was. One night she dumped a cocktail down the back of a woman's dress and it ruined this woman's mink coat, and she just tore out and ripped Reverend Taylor apart before she was Reverend Taylor. In fact, Barbara said that one night she came home and she took a shower, not because she couldn't handle the smoke and the smells and all the stuff that she'd been dealing with in the restaurant that night, but she wanted to wash away what she called the malignant meanness of the customers she'd served. Being a servant is hard. Although Reverend Taylor also pointed out, after she was ordained, she became a hospital chaplain. And she said that the sicker the patient, the more grateful they were for even the smallest thing. She recalls one patient who was nearing the end of her life. Barbara walked in. She was the chaplain. There wasn't really anything for her to do. So she just took a hold of that woman's hand. And the woman turned and looked at her and said, "This is like the hand of God." That's what service does. Service is the hand of God reaching out to someone else in a moment of pain, in a moment of need. That's what Joshua wants the people to see. That's what he wants them to understand. You'd better be ready to do whatever it takes to follow this God in this God's ways. It's not easy. It's not simple. It won't feel good. You may not want to get up in the morning. But it's your calling. But in their enthusiasm, Joshua just has this sense that they don't really get it. Later in 24, Joshua 24, he says, you can't do it. Don't even try because you're not going to work out and it's not going to go very well. But they reply again, "Oh no, we mean it. We will. We'll be fine. We can do it. It'll be fine, Joshua." The rest of his sermon is kind of a half-hearted effort on his part to inspire them. He seems to know that it just won't work. Have you ever experienced that? Maybe at your office one day and you call in your staff and you say, "Hey, it's going to be hard. Man, this row that we're about to hoe is going to be very, very tough and rocky." And they're, "Oh, yeah, well, don't worry, we can do it." But you have a sense in your mind, boy, I'm not sure they get it. Maybe at home you've called your family around and there's been a disease that's been named. Or even worse, someone you love has died and you bring your family, your close relatives in and you say, "I need you to stand with me. Will you be here with me?" And, "Oh, yeah, we will," but that enthusiasm kind of fades. You ever seen that before? Many years ago, when I was serving another church, I was working with a young couple who was preparing for marriage. They were a beautiful couple. He was handsome. She was beautiful, gorgeous. They were very successful in their early 30s, 31, 32 years old. Both had graduate degrees. Both already had very successful careers. They were bringing in well over $1 million between their two incomes. Had already bought a beautiful home for the beginning of their married life together. But they were doing some work with me, work that we do here at Country Club called the Prepare and Enrich. It was a prepare inventory to help them get ready for their marriage. And the results came back and, well, the scores were not very good, and it was really indicative that there were some serious issues that they needed to pay attention to. Some concerns, some growth areas in every single category across the board. I reviewed these with them and we talked about them. And at the end of the session I said, "You know, I want you to know I'm not a trained marriage therapist. I really would like to send you to one. Someone who can help you work on these things." And they both said, You don't need to do that. We've been to school. We understand what we're dealing with here. We'll be fine." I said, "No, really, seriously, these are major concerns. I think you need someone trained who can guide you." "No, we don't need this. We'll be fine. Let's plan the wedding." Now, if I was Joshua, I would have said, "Choose this day what you're going to do about this, because this is serious." But I'm just Glenn, and I said, "Okay, fine." Well, the wedding was amazing. I mean, it was amazing. They hired 20 limousines to bring all the wedding guests. 20 limousines gathered around the church. The church was filled with enough flowers for 20 weddings. They had three soloists. They had a string quartet. It was unbelievable. Then we went to the reception, and it was even more so. I mean, there was a live band, open bar, 500 guests served a sit-down filet mignon dinner. I did the math in my head. I figured it was around $100,000 that they spent, at least. And you already know the end of the story, don't you? It was barely 10 months before lawyers were hired, finances were divided, the house was sold, and the marriage was over. Choose this day. When Joshua stands before his audience, when Joshua stands before us, he knows that all of us bring a certain naivete. It feels good in the moment. "Yes, sir, we're ready to go." But it's almost as though Joshua is saying, "Really? Really? Love your enemies?" That's what Jesus whose name, by the way, is Joshua. That's the anglicized version of his name. Jesus and Joshua are asking a similar question. Really? Can you love your enemies? Can you pray for those who persecute you? Can you find time in your very busy schedules to care for someone who's hungry? Are you ready? Can you do that? You see, behind Joshua's instruction is the Ten Commandments. He doesn't quote them, but it seems to be implied in his sermon. Especially this one, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Let's stop there for a moment and ask ourselves, do you have other gods? Are there other gods, false ones, in your life? Don't answer too quickly. Buzz Thomas, a good Baptist preacher, asks a similar question. Are there any false gods in your life? Are they money? Status? Fame? Youth? Power? Have you in your life been honest in your dealings with others? Have you cheated on your spouse? Cheated on a business partner? Cheated the United States of America on your taxes? Are there any other gods in our lives? False gods. You can see the point. When Joshua calls on them to choose this day the one God, he knows how easy it is to get distracted by all these little g gods, these false ideas that pull us away, that pull us aside. He knows how easy it is to sing the songs, to pray the prayers, to gather at the table, to marvel at the beauty of our musicians and the power of their music, and then walk out the door and just forget it all as though it never happened. And let me tell you, I'm preaching to Glenn right now as much as anybody else. How easy it is to feel good in the moment, excited and ready to go, and then, well, we got work to do. And it's as though it never happened. Well, my dad's one of my favorite preachers, and Joshua is one of my favorites. Let me close with a quote from another one that I love to read, one who's inspired my ministry, especially since I've come here to this congregation for these 10 years. He preached once, this one. How can we, in light of the fact that we shall have to meet Jesus at the cross, how could we look up smug and complacent, our hands full of money, the comforts of this earth, all ours, how could we look up into the face of Jesus and believe that these things, this stuff in our hands, are really the deepest meaning of existence? How could we have a faith that guarantees us a way to get everything women and men dream for when our dreams won't pass the muster? It's our dreams that are the problem, he wrote. What about our dreams? When are they going to be changed? Can we have a faith that is built on God's love, God's sacrifice, and God's forgiveness? Those words were spoken first in this pulpit in 1961 by Lawrence Bash, senior minister, 1960 to 1978. How can we, he said, stand at the foot of the cross, our hands full of stuff, as that's all that we really care about? How can we stand before the God of love and forgiveness and sacrifice and think that's what that God wants? It's not easy. This way is hard. But Bash is right. Maybe it's our dreams that need review. Can we dream of a church built on faith in a God who loves everyone? And when I say everyone, that means everyone. Can we dream of a church that is willing to go anywhere, whether it's across the street, across Troost, or across the world, to serve the least of these? Can we dream of a church whose halls are filled with old and young, rich and poor, black and white, anyone and everyone? Can we dream of that church? Are we ready to allow the dreams of God to be our dreams. Choose this day whom you will serve, and God's dreams will be ours.